have police photographing our license plate.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, and this is the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I have a special guest today. We did introduce the director, Diego Organo, of Bob and the Trees. Well, today we have Bob, the Bob of Bob and the Trees, Bob Tarasuk. Did I get it right, Bob?
Yes, perfect.
Oh, well, hello, and how are you, for heaven's sake?
I am well, thank you.
Well, it's
thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I saw the film. It's an amazing story, and I guess we should, right off the bat, we should make clear to people, Bob hasn't necessarily pursued an acting career on or off camera, but he is both the star of the movie. The movie is about him, but he also plays the character Bob. Can you explain that to us? We talked to Diego about it, but what do you think, Bob? How was it being you and then playing you at the same time?
It's unbelievable. Diego and I became friends quite some time ago when he moved into Sandusfield, and I do have a degree in natural resource management, which is the management of wildlife, fisheries, and forestry. I have a forestry license, and I've been practicing forestry for 35 years here in Sandusfield, working mostly, if not only, with private landowners who own land up in the Berkshires.
Uh-huh.
So we met, Diego and I met, and probably many years ago, he was sort of keeping track of the things that were going on with our farm and forestry with this idea to have a movie. So it was, when he had asked me to do it, I had never even considered or thought about acting, and it seemed a natural fit because much of what's in the movie has taken place in my life to some degree. It is a fictional movie, but so much of it parallels what I lived through and have lived through so closely that it was a natural fit, and it wasn't a totally difficult task for me to play Bob.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't. So I found it fairly easy, and then I was just blown away recently when I actually saw the film for the first time on the big screen, and I'm sort of just it's just amazing.
It is, you know, and the cinematography, and I think also, and I'm glad you jumped right in with that. I meant to say that because you are a forester, and that it involves a lot more than most of us think. We think we think of loggers and cutting down trees, and you either complain about that or you don't. Or you don't know anything about it to begin with. But I have to say, as I told Diego, I had an experience as a child watching several uncles. I mean, I'm Italian. The family's big. So there were a number of uncles all being a part of this to take down this huge tree, enormous tree that had grown up with all of them, but right next to my grandmama's home. And one day they decided it might be a danger, you know, in a storm or something, so we should cut it down. And I had never thought about that again, even though that day I remember vividly as a child. But when I saw, and again, the movie is Bob and the Trees, when I saw you out there all alone with your power saw and taking on these trees, I said to Diego, you know, I'm remembering this and all the
the discussion, and of course, being Italians, I don't know if we can call it a discussion, but they were certainly talking around each other about how to do it. But you go out there, as in the movie, do you go often by yourself? You do the math, which means figuring out where this is going to fall and where you have to cut it and when to cut it and if it's safe and all that. Do you do that on your own?
Yeah, correctly. What happens is what's confusing mainly is a forester is a person who works for a landowner, someone who owns property, helping them decide how to make decisions about their forest. Mm. A logger is logging is the tool to accomplish that. So if you owned a piece of land, 100 acres, and you wanted to do the right thing and say, well, I'm interested in growing trees, I'm interested in wildlife habitat, I'd love to have some hiking trails. A forester with my background is the person that you want, because you're going to be able to accomplish those objectives through a management plan or management. And then I would... And I do logging, and my son's in the logging business, and I work with him. And then we use the tool of logging to thin the forest. That's why you see trees being marked with paint, because the forester decides which trees should be removed to accomplish the objectives.
Mm-hmm.
We then contracting and supervising the thinning itself, and that's sort of, if not, yeah, that's exactly what the movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the industry, the logging industry, the sawmill industry is a very volatile industry, and so very often you, as a logger or a landowner, things are, it's hard for me to describe it, but the markets for logs and the markets for the species in the Northeast, like oak and cherry and ash and beech and maple, they change so frequently that the loggers have not only maybe one of the most dangerous jobs that there you could possibly imagine,
yes,
being out there with trees flying all over the
exactly
place. They often struggle a lot with trying to make a living, and so you have an unbelievably dangerous job. It's not, sometimes you're okay and you can make your living, and sometimes you just, as the movie kind of shows, it's just really impossible. And so those things, some of the things in the movie that's exciting is that it those things took place and have taken place, and Diego has picked up on those things over the years and has put together and represented. I think maybe one of the most exciting things for me is that the loggers in the region that I know very well saw the movie recently and are just amazed and ecstatic and pleased and happy how well it was represented and how real it actually is. So it's I'm acting there, but I'm me, and I'm and I've lived in it.
Yes, it's true. And you know, and if your peers, your neighbors, are those who share in this occupation, are pleased with what they see, then I think that's probably the highest compliment. But I have to tell you, I was just mesmerized by it. It is what we call in the business a slice of life film.
Yeah.
But it tells the story, as I said to Diego, it lets the camera tell the story without the camera being noticed, and that's the fantastic, one of the best things about it, I think, is that you go through your life and the trials and challenges and ups and downs and all that, entertaining each other at the end of the day around the dinner table. I of course can relate to that being Italian, but it's just so real, and yet we're getting this information. I mean, I'm a New York City boy, I'm getting this information anyway about something I really never thought I knew about or didn't know about, but I didn't. The one experience I remember, I said, you, and yet my grandmama had a huge estate, if you will, and sold trees to the state of Virginia, and she was quite, you know, I don't think she went past the seventh grade, but she made a deal that we still talk about. The Virginia could cut down the trees that she said, but they had to plant new trees and guarantee they'd come back in 50 years or whatever, and cut those down. So, as a matter of fact, now I can ask someone who knows, does that sound like a good deal, a smart move, or is that normal?
It's probably probably pretty normal for Virginia. There's different ways to manage forests, and I know the southern forests are much different in their species composition than it is up here, so they have different strategies for management. And often if the trees are a certain species, like loblolly pine or other species, then the right thing to do is to grow them to a point, cut them, replant them, grow them to maturity, and then cut them again. If you're working with a really diverse forest like we are here, which is every hardwood under the sun, it's pretty exciting actually, then you're totally treating the forest different, so you're thinning more. So yeah, that definitely probably sounds pretty normal.
All right. Well, I'm so glad, seriously, to be able to ask someone like you about things like this, because it was only as a kid, and I mean a kid, you know, under 10, visiting my grandmama and seeing things like this, and now I can put them into perspective. But you keep saying here, we should tell people, to be clear, you're up in Massachusetts, yes?
Yes, I'm about 2.5 hours from New York City. It's the Berkshires,
yes.
Southwest corner of Massachusetts. We own a beautiful farm and have been farming for the same amount of time when we moved here just over 35 years ago. And it is a very rural, farmy area.
Yes.
Really is, and like our population in our town is very small, 600 to 800 local people, maybe 1,200 to 1,400 with absentee owners, and yet it's the largest acreage township in the state. So it's very rural, it's beautiful, and it's the perfect setting for farming and for especially forestry. It's like one of the something that's a go-to for an occupation with lots of loggers and people that make their life around the forest products industry and firewood and really earthy, tough stuff. And so, yeah, the Berkshires are beautiful. Our town is Sandusfield. That's a pretty obscure town that I'm sure very few have ever heard about. And maybe one of the places that might ring bells with folks is the Butternut Ski Area and the town of Great Barrington, which is a very cultural up-and-coming town and lots of fun things to do there. So, yeah, the Berkshires are beautiful, and that's why there are a lot of absentee owners that buy large parcels of land, and many of them, if not all of them, buy this land, first of all, because they love the privacy, and second of all, because they love the land. So it makes a wonderful fit for me because I get the privilege, actually, to work with owners of land who really care about their land, who aren't just saying, hey, how much money can I get for my trees? I want to cut them all. You know, I'm working with people that say, what can I do to grow trees? What can I do to help wildlife, to hike? What can I do to protect our water resources by not allowing any negative impacts from logging? So it's an awesome place for somebody like me to make a living, and it perpetuates itself over time, because if you say, like I am getting old enough, I'm definitely old enough now to have thinned properties 25 years ago.
Wow.
That have been growing trees since then, and I have a file cabinet, and I go back, and it's time to do some more work, and the trees are spectacular, and much bigger, and the reward is better for having the patience to do the right thing many years ago.
Yes, it is fascinating to know, and again, I was just a child, but Virginia came after the trees. My grandmama had to be talked into it, but then when she made the arrangement that she did, I always heard exactly what you're saying. She was thinking ahead and to replenish the forest and make certain they did that and didn't just take and not give. What prompted you? I mean, how does one decide to be a forester? What is there a point in your life where, when other kids were saying they wanted to grow up and be a fireman, that you said, no, I want to be a forester?
That is not even close. I was actually born and raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know Bridgeport, yes.
The furthest thing that you could probably come up with, I bet, from where I am today.
Yes.
And we moved, my wife and I, she was 20, I was 19 when we got married, and we moved out of Bridgeport to Hartford, worked for an insurance company, and after about a year there, because I had an associate's degree in computer programming, after a year there, I ran into somebody who was working there, and he just said, he just went back to school, the University of Connecticut, and I said, what is it about? And he was just screaming and jumping up and down about how he's taking fisheries classes and wildlife classes, and he's just so excited and just said, wow. He said, yeah, check it out. And I went and took a few part-time classes, and it blew me away. And I said, wow, maybe someday I can just get paid to fish and hunt and you know.
Yes.
But that was dreaming, but it ended up in the end. I've made my living managing forest land, which I love land, period, and managing it for those for fisheries protection and wildlife habitat. So it was, I don't know what you call that. It wasn't something I thought of ahead of time. It was something that happened, and I just love doing it today still. So
well, you must have had a great love for the land, as you say.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
And so here was the opportunity. As you say, I've had that same kind of conversation with myself. I mean, I love the land and animals and the forests, and mine is a little more selfish, I would say. There are fewer and fewer places where a city boy can get in the car and find a back road to take some photographs where, you know, where few people have been. And there you are with the deer, and once there was a bear, but we won't go to that story. But to be able to do that, just as a personal part-time getaway, is becoming more and more difficult. So I would think also for people in the forestry business to be able to be in such an area with the acreage and as you say, it's a decade, it's a lifetime. You don't just cut down a few trees and go away. It's the planning, and that's what I want to hear more about in the next segment. How you are very much the 21st century mathematical, computer savvy guy who goes in and figures out, like a chess game, this, you know, how to exactly. And you rattle off all the names of the different trees, and I'm going, oh my God, you know, I've heard those trees, but would I really know one if I saw it, so to speak?
It's interesting you say that, because one of the maybe the best things for me in working with a property owner from the city is that they come up and they buy a piece of land and they are totally disconnected from,
yes,
from land. You know,
yes,
they are exactly what you're saying, and they come up here and to start with, it's an education to walk with them and talk about their land and get to understand it. And then by the time we're through with our visit and our management strategies, they get so connected,
yes,
to their land, and they see what I see. They see the trees, they see the beautiful vistas or the wetlands and the birds, and it's a revelation often for so many people. And that's what I think is maybe the best part of what I do, is helping,
yes,
people connect to the land and just, holy cow, really? Where? Huh? What? there's a big rock that looks over a view over the, you know, it's amazing some of the things that take place, and they go from totally not ever seeing anything like that to totally being in love with their land. So it's that's the biggest reward I have. And that's probably, every time I get a call from someone who says, hey, I got a piece of land, I'd love you to look at it and give me some ideas, I am so ready to see another new 100 acres, 1,000 acres, 50 acres, 10 acres. I'm just excited to keep, because it's usually that's the way it is to go see somewhere new, a new resource, maybe a brook, a stream, a wetland. It's exciting in that regard.
That's incredible, Bob. And by the way, that's not too different from a film director explaining to cinematographers and actors to see the scene that he wants to produce. So there you go. Well, listen, we're going to take a short break. I'm talking to Bob Terasuk. I think I got it right again. And he is a forester who is telling us a lot about the trees and saving the land and the animals and nature and the love of it, because without people like Bob, it disappears, let me tell you. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about farming, because Bob does that as well, farm animals, and the weather. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Bob Terasuk.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Movie geeks, take note. Quartet is Dustin Hoffman's first directing credit. Let us see what this old pro might have up his artistic sleeve. Ah, no tricks, deep meaning, or acting bravado. Just a delightful stroll through an old age home filled with funny and lovable retired performers. Sure, there are threads of a plot. One couple were married once, but she cheated soon after the wedding, and he has never forgiven her. She was a big star and is still a diva, and arrives to shake up the place with her airs and demands. Another thread is the unlikely need to put on a show, ostensibly to save their beloved retirement home with the proceeds. But for the show to work, the old lovers must reunite, and our diva must be able to hit a note she is no longer confident can be reached. Not exactly heavy material, but we celebrate quartet for what may be the best reason of all. It's simply enjoyable entertainment. Here we have another entry into the silver dollar trend, films on senior subjects populated by the most appealing of elder stars. The humanity is real, the laughs strike true, and we learn that Dustin Hoffman respects us by not taking himself too seriously. What's not to like? Quartet. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at indiefilmminute.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, Forrester Bob Tarasuk. Am I getting it? Am I close, Bob? I don't want to.
You have got it.
Okay, very good. And Bob, in our last segment, we were talking a great deal about his life, his lifestyle, his career, his commitment to the land. That in itself is marvelous, but we also want to mention that Bob is both Bob in Bob and the Trees as himself, but also playing a fictionalized character of himself. But one of the things, a couple of things we haven't mentioned so far in depth anyway, is that Bob is also, would be fair to say, a farmer. At least you have animals, you have cows,
and
you have to protect them, and that is part of what's in the film. And now that it's out, I guess we can say a few more things than I was able to with Diego. We didn't want to give away too much, but there is a special cow. Is that cow really yours and special to you, as it seemed to be in the film?
It absolutely is. It's been with us. It's a retired dairy cow that belonged to a friend, and we took him here to retire many years ago, 10 years ago anyway, and she's the love of the town. She was the love of the town, and in regards to farming today, there's such a, I don't know if you call it trendy or what, but there's such a movement to go to the farm for sustainable products nowadays. Uh-huh. People want grass-fed lamb. They want, grass-fed beef.
Sure.
It's unbelievable how much focus is on local farming. And we started doing this, like I said, 35 years ago.
Yes.
When sustainable farming wasn't fashionable, it was what we did.
Yes.
And so, yes, we have a lot of animals. We have 20 sheep. We have baby lambs every year. I have a barn full of them right now. They're pregnant, ready to birth. As I talk to you, I have an amazing big giant sow that is in labor.
Wow.
And it's a terrible time because it's, I don't know what it's like there, but it's going to be zero here tonight.
Yes.
And so I got heaters on her and lamps, and she's one pig that's going to have probably 14 little baby pigs tonight.
Wow.
Or tomorrow. And we have some cows for beef. We've always fed our family. I have three children, not children anymore, but mm-hmm. I have three kids. And they haven't eaten nothing but from our farm. And
wow.
We raise everything, pork, beef, lamb, chicken, turkey, and it's always been spread amongst them all to have big freezers and to have fully have their annual food from this farm. So that's the bulk of what we do. And when there's overflow or extra, friends and family and some people in the region, I do all of the butchering and slaughtering myself.
Wow.
And they get to buy some of it from me. So it's not our living, it's our love.
Yes.
And it's sort of a part-time love that doesn't make any money. farming just doesn't.
Yeah.
But we've been doing this a lot, and quite honestly, it'd be very difficult for us to go to the grocery store and buy any kind of meat at all. So we're pretty spoiled in that regard.
Yes.
We feel like we really got the best, and that's why we do it.
You know, the family-owned farm, is, I don't need to tell you, but it's so in the minority, except as you say, people are becoming aware of organic food and range grazing, and it's a healthy thing. And of course, we have a lot, even in Virginia, just outside of D.C., where I live, buy local, when the farms go, what's left? I mean, all kinds of bumper stickers that make us aware of the situation. And as a kid, again, visiting my grandmama, I saw the hogs slaughtered. I learned about the birds and the bees sort of because one day my cousins, I had an uncle not too much older than we, but my cousin was 9 months older than I, and they were supposed to take the cow to visit the bull down the road or so, which was it's a whole nother world. Until I talk to you, I feel like I'm right there. You know, tie up the cow, and you walk down the dirt road, and you walk forever, and then finally you end up where the bull is. And I had lots of questions for my grandmama when I got home.
I think I love that the most when people, we have a greenhouse operation. We've sold stuff out of our greenhouse over the years, a small retail business. And because our farm is very beautiful and it's sort of a centerpiece or focal point of Sandusfield, we had lots of people come just to see the farm.
Yes.
But often I come back from work and there's people in the barn or they're out with the animals and so on and so forth. And I think that's one of the greatest things is because there's so many people that where are you going to go see this?
Exactly.
And then as we get to know them over time and they keep coming and they learn so much about animal husbandry and farming and they're fascinated. It's really amazing that people, you know, when they get hands on and get in there,
yes,
how much. And if they've never had, how much they want to be a part of it and learn. So I've often fantasized about having some educational things here for agriculture just because so many people from the city buy land up here and like I said, are very disconnected, so they want to learn about it. And it's a place for that. It's like you did. You went and you learned about the birds and the bees.
Yes.
And that's that. Little kids come here, and lots of parents say, wow, you know, I want them to come and work with you this summer. And
yes.
Like that. And so the farm is an educational tool, and it's a great place, and it's part of why we do it, to spread it around and educate people about the food source. And
sure.
That's what makes people happy is when they know where the food's coming from.
Yes. And with that comes, I think, a healthy respect for those who provide that food, you know, the farm workers, the farm owners, and what you do with the forestry to not only deliver the logs, but to preserve the forest. It's what we used to be, and it's not for the faint of heart. People, it takes brains. It takes being able to get on the computer, and it takes mathematics. Math was never my subject. I keep mentioning that, Bob, because as I watched you in Bob in the Trees, I'm going, you know, he is calculating like crazy out there and how to make this work. And it's not, you know, you have to really respect that. But I want to say this. While watching the movie, and I know a lot of people, as you say, people coming from the city, they buy the property, they appreciate the beauty of the snow and the area and whatever, but you mentioned it's going to be zero tonight as you tend to your sow. How does the weather impact you and your family and your business?
The weather is the factor for both logging and farming. It is the most important factor. It has the largest impact. And when you think about logging, just quickly, there's big negative spin about logging. People, like you said, may like it or they don't.
Yes.
And, most people don't. Most people just see it as a negative thing of, you know, ruining land, cutting trees, raping forests. It's always had a tough reputation. And part of that is because of how hard it is to do, and when it's raining out and it's warm and it's muddy and people need to make their living, it
yes.
doesn't look so good. But when you when the ground is frozen and it's zero out like it is today, that suddenly becomes a huge positive for the logging industry because the trails are beautiful, they're
yes.
frozen, they're hard, there's no mud, and it looks nice. And it was same with farming. I have a sow that's going to give birth in the next couple of days. It was a bad break because it shouldn't be giving birth this time of year, but I have this giant boar who
yes.
decided that he was going to tear my wall apart and get at that sow no matter what, and broke fence, and there we go. So,
yes.
So the weather is critical. The sheep historically and always have lambs in the middle of winter, it seems, when it's the coldest night, and lambs can deal with it because they come out with wool on them. The mother licks them clean even if it's zero, and there's a miracle standing there, and a baby lamb when it's zero out is nursing on its mother. So there's a lot easier for them to do that. And cows, you just try never to breed them so that they have their calves in the wintertime.
Yes.
And you know, there's all the rest of what the weather does to all of your vegetables, and if it's raining like crazy, and all the rot and the fungus that comes. So the weather plays maybe the largest factor in both farming and forestry and logging operations, most important factor.
I can believe that because I'm certainly not on a farm anymore. Not that I ever lived on one, but at least I got to visit them on some basis. But just this cold front that has hit most of the country and our area as well. I know a couple of farmers in Lynchburg, and you know, in the middle of the night, doing what they had to do to make certain the pipes didn't burst. And there's just so much more to it, and it seems like it's a rugged, demanding career. One has to really love it. What?
The movie shows that
yes.
very well.
Yes.
How tough things can be.
And also with today's economy, I mean, there's so many people in government as saying that the Great Recession is over, but I don't meet many people that I talk to that feel it is. How does the economy impact on a farmer and a forester?
Right now, we're gasoline. I just put gas in my car today, and it was $2.15. And if you don't think that has an impact on how
yes.
on machinery, when logging is giant steel machinery of skidders and oh my God, just big machinery that uses so much fuel. This is the what's happening with gasoline, just that alone, and diesel fuel plays a huge role. And the economy, if it's, like I said, it's pretty, logs and the markets for them are volatile. So if suddenly the demand for ash and cherry and like red oak, for instance, has always been historically a wonderful species to use for hardwood flooring.
Yes.
If people don't like red oak anymore.
Yeah.
things, and that is what happened over 35 years. The markets change, they fluctuate, and I don't know, the economy is everything to farming and forestry. And right now, I want to say, honestly, things are pretty good at the moment. Because the markets are pretty good for the logs. There's a big demand from China for our products. And then as far as, like I said, the farming, creative farmers are starting to take advantage of this trend that local food is important and healthy. And so there's these creative little niche markets popping up for homemade, homegrown stuff. And it's been awesome to be a part of it and help, you know, move that forward. So it's, and then people come and want to learn how to do it, and they go back home and they get a couple of chickens, and the next thing you know, they have some eggs. And it's simple, how simple that was. And I so many people are experimenting and doing things like that. And so, yeah, and I wouldn't say that that doing all that, or farming or raising your own, necessarily is less expensive, is saving you any money, but it sure is providing you with an incredible product.
Sure. I'm just wondering, is there, or do you want even, do you want to give a website or something where people can find out more about your part-time love?
Yes,
okay.
I'd love to do that. I'm happy to do that. And of the movie, we have a bobinthetrees.com website for following what's going to happen here.
Yes.
As we head to Sundance, which I can't believe I'm even telling you that.
Yeah.
And then, we have our the name of our farm here in Sandusfield is Snow Farm, and yeah. Anybody in the region that happens to go to the Berkshires is certainly welcome to stop by and see this beautiful historic farm and
yes.
The animals and visit and say hello. So those are the two go-to sites, I guess.
Yes. And how, Bob, as we get close to the end here, I want to ask you, do you, you mentioned how, you know, the redwood, and sometimes people have loved it, and then other times certain trees or certain wood is out of fashion or whatever. Is part of what you do to be successful, to survive, is you have to sort of anticipate the market. I mean, you know, today they love this kind of tree, but so I'm going to plant those in anticipation that 20 years from now they're going to love them again. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, you always have to anticipate the markets and the trends and what's coming. In our forests up here, we count on natural reproduction.
Uh-huh.
There's never planting. So, but we have so many species that if you planted, they couldn't keep up with that anyway.
Uh-huh.
So the natural reproduction is vigorous around here,
mm-hmm.
and so you have to anticipate the markets. You really do.
You know, and I mentioned earlier on that what impressed me in so many ways is you out there alone with your power chainsaw, but we have to also reiterate what you were just saying a moment ago, and that is there's an awful lot of big equipment. I mean, once you cut the tree down, you've got to get it where you need it to be.
You saw that big machine there.
Oh, yes. So what do you, I mean, there's maintenance, there's, you know, maintaining that year-round, whether it's actually working or not, and of course, when gas prices were up over $3.50 a gallon, wow, how do you do that?
You struggle more,
yes.
and you suffer a lot, and loggers historically have, and it's just a hard, but there's so much, you get bit by it. It's almost like you have this sawdust in your blood. Once
yes.
you start doing it, you just take whatever comes, and you try to make the best of it. If you don't mind, I'll say one quick thing.
Sure.
Just related to trees and tree species. Currently in our area, we have maybe one of the most prolific trees in our area is the white ash. It's a beautiful tree. It's used primarily for handles, horticulture tools, baseball bats. That's its primary use, and it's used internationally for those products.
Uh-huh.
Currently, this is what I'm talking about to foresee things. There's a bug, an insect called the emerald ash borer that
yes.
has come from overseas, and people are starting to really hear about it and learn about it. And it's decimated this species from the Midwest all the way to here in all of the states, and completely its intent is to eliminate the species. And it's been found recently here in the Berkshires, and all eyes are on it. And of course, that has a lot to do with what are we going to do, because this species is so important for our hand tools and its properties and qualities. And so what do we do now? What if this actually does disappear, and what's going to replace it? It's things like that that are always ongoing, and
yes.
You have to keep track of. And once the ash is gone, if it is, we'll hope that it comes back again.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we shift our focus on other species. But we have a lot of different species in the Northeast. It's pretty awesome.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I meant to ask you about, it's covered in Bob and the Trees, that you can cut down a tree. I guess with someone like you, it is possible to look at the tree and have some sense of what's going on inside of it. But in many cases, as demonstrated in the film, you cut down the tree hoping that it's something you can use, and then you find it's infested with one
right.
thing or another. And
yeah.
you've done all that work and all that gasoline and all that time is definitely not a routine 9-to-5, that's for sure.
No, that is exactly. There's so much risk and so much unknown, and it doesn't matter how long you're at it, and trees are growing and things are happening, and animals use them for their homes, often
yes.
their cavities in the trees for all kinds of mammals, and then other bugs and insects, and so it's a high-risk thing in that regard. You look at a tree, it looks great, and you pay for it, you cut it down, and it isn't. That's what makes it so hard. It's often you're rolling the dice as a logger or a florister to make your living.
Okay. Well, it is a challenge, and the best of the best are the ones who can meet it, and Bob is one of those. We've been talking with Bob Tarasuk, who is the star, the leading man, the character, and the protagonist who the movie is about in Bob and the Trees. Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and best of luck with all the birthing going on up there in 0 degrees.
I'll be out there tonight.
I can just imagine. Anyway, Bob, it's been great talking to you and wish you all the very best. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Scorpions, Whitesnake, Bon Jovi. If you're a rock and roll fan, you'll recognize those as some of the biggest bands of the 80s. At giant concerts, these famous acts shared billing with another band that you have likely never heard of, Anvil. This genre-defining Canadian heavy metal band is profiled in the documentary Anvil, The Story of Anvil. It follows the principal members of Anvil lead singer Lips Kudlow and drummer Rob Reiner, no relation to the director of This Is Spinal Tap. After 25 years of playing together, Lips and Reiner have now become ordinary family men, still pursuing their dream of gaining respect and recognition. Then, in quick order, they are booked for a European tour that quickly turns disastrous, receive an opportunity to record an album with a renowned producer, and have more than one I quit moment. But Anvil doesn't paint a picture of failure. It has a strong comedic sense of self-mockery, and it takes the time to show off Lips and Reiner at their best, in front of sold-out crowds and adoring fans. Anvil is a funny, captivating film about passion and survival with a fast-beating heart and triumphant spirit. And isn't that what rock and roll is all about? Anvil, The Story of Anvil. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Missing you and us, too. There was little reason for my grandmama to leave her huge farm to go into town, a few miles away, for groceries, gasoline, farm equipment, overalls, and newspapers. Now I only go back for the funerals and to hear on the breeze what I've missed. I'm not into romanticizing the past, believing things, for the most part, are always improving, until G.W. and Cheney, of course, as long as what's new doesn't obliterate what's been with what's coming round the bend. I don't miss Mayberry or my slumlord friends on Shelter Island, but I do miss New York City neighborhoods, walking city blocks, and being constantly in rehearsals for something. I miss Gypsy and Heinrich, best and worst watchdogs, respectively. Don't miss Dad and Mom so much as it still feels like they're here. But I do miss people who trim their trees back from power lines, so when the winds come, we keep our AC. I miss hailing a yellow cab for Carol Channing, strolling Midtown with Colleen Dewhurst, and chatting with James Whitmore about the next voice you hear. He said I was too young to have seen it, but while other boys my age were outside playing ball, I was watching old movies on TV. Mr. Whitmore was so proud of the fact that he had made the movie with Nancy Reagan before she met Ronnie. But I told him I would never forget what it felt like when God spoke to him on his radio. I miss that. I miss taking time to tune up with morning prayers and reel-to-reel Gregorian chant. I don't miss fast cars and curvy roads, for that's still how I relax. I miss Jimmy Stewart and Harvey, Yul Brynner and the American Original Six, Gregory Peck, whom Mom told, my son is an actor too. I never miss Florida, except when I think of hurricanes 250 miles offshore pinning me against the lifeguard chair, streaking back my hair with beach sand, my lips rimmed like a margarita glass, and the ocean some distance away lapping occasionally at my toes, as a seagull above makes no headway because of headwinds. I miss the silence that can only be heard without the din, and I miss people who understand the wisdom in that. I miss Marvin's white boots as much as our drama classes. I miss my voice lessons with Wayne and Ernie, and both the Peabody and Baltimore Opera in the days of George Woodhead and Bill Januzzi, the only man who smoked more cigarettes than my 61-year-old brother, just diagnosed with the lungs of an 80-year-old. I miss him already. For me, missing is more happy memories than sad longing. But I do miss not seeing my best friend Lance Thomas Vining. However, I don't miss the Silver Diner, his favorite dining choice. I do miss my annual trips to Europe, but it was a wonderful career that suspended them, so we make our choices. I miss dates on letters, even to find telephone numbers on bills, and I miss sleeping more than 5 hours a night. But most of all, I miss who we were in the 60s. I miss Abraham, Martin, and John, and Bobby, too. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.